Hello, I'm Michael Lemon. This is number 0302, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0302. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Kevin Biggins, co-executive producer of Family Guy. What makes Family Guy different from The Simpsons?
The thing that differentiates us a little bit is just, you know, our kind of cutaway style with flashbacks and different non sequiturs. And in that way, we can kind of just hit maybe a little bit more pop culture things that are going on. And I think we're probably a meaner show as well, but that's okay. But, you know, there's nothing but respect as far as Simpsons come.
Dr. Leslie Beth Wish on the topic of good versus bad wedding proposals. What do over-the-top proposals tell you?
You know, when the proposal's written in the sky, or it's, you know, done at some stadium that's rented, or some, you know, mountaintop or whatever, and it's very easy to get swept away. But keep in mind that proposals that suffer from too muchness can often be tells, and they might be telling you that these are men who need to be in charge, respected, and revered, and number one, two, and three in a relationship.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter takes a behind-the-scenes look at the White House in the residence. So hail to the people who make 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue tick. It's all coming soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0302, was Michael Lemon, a listener here in Montreal to the Stuff File program. Thank you very much, Mike, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, you know, there are friends, and there are friends, and then there are friends like Elijah Ray Lambert, who was willing to shoot you in the chest. Yeah. And with friends like those, you know, who needs enemies? Lambert was friends with the late Miguel Martinez. That's right, I said the late Miguel Martinez of Citrus Heights, California. Now, somewhere, Miguel got hold of a bulletproof vest and decided he wanted to test it to see if it would really stop a bullet. But why put it on a mannequin or tie it to a tree when you can put it on yourself, right? As long as you have a friend like Lambert who is willing to pull the trigger for you. Deputies arrested Lambert for the shooting, but the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department has characterized the incident as an unintentional killing. Martinez's brother reported that the bullet had actually penetrated the top of his vest, indicating that not only does Lambert have bad judgment, he also has a lousy aim. Anyway, the pair were with two other friends, the police said. The group initially reported the shooting as a robbery, but later confessed to it as being an accident. This was a tough choice, by the way, to decide whether this was simply a Darwin file story, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Or if it was an idiot of the day story, because we truly have a couple of them here, but in the end, it wins in the Darwin file. And also in the end, as misguided as they were, isn't it nice to have close friends that you can really trust? Literally, right to the bitter end. Yeah. 26-year-old Daniel Palmer allegedly robbed a tourist at gunpoint in Miami Beach, Florida. According to police, Palmer pointed his gun at the victim, grabbed the gold chain around his neck, and took off. A block later, Palmer allegedly approached the victim again to let him know that the chain he had stolen was fake. That was a brazen move, and because of that, he was able to be apprehended, said Detective Ernesto Rodriguez. Palmer was charged with armed robbery, fleeing and eluding, reckless driving, and possession of a suspended license. Is it really fleeing and eluding if he comes back to chastise the victim about his knockoff? Yeah. And why do these criminals always have a suspended license? Does anybody who commits a crime ever have a valid license anymore? A Seattle couple said a burglar stole a pair of sunglasses from their car but ignored something far more valuable, a $1 million winning Powerball ticket. The couple, who requested anonymity, obviously for good reason, said they forgot to check the number of their Powerball ticket when it failed to win the $350 million jackpot prize back in February's drawing. "We didn't even think about a second chance prize," the couple told Washington's lottery officials. They said the ticket sat in their car for about 3 months. "Someone broke into our car a few weeks ago and stole a pair of sunglasses," the couple said. The sunglasses, the stolen sunglasses, were actually sitting atop the winning ticket. What a close call. The couple checked the numbers on their ticket May 14th and discovered they had won $1 million second chance prize. "Well, we already popped a bottle of champagne. We're also planning a trip to Paris and Iceland for this year. Other than that, I think we'll just take care of our house," the couple said. The Seattle Imam store that sold the ticket, by the way, will receive a $10,000 selling bonus, according to the lottery. The burglar, meanwhile, will have to do with a pair of used sunglasses. Interesting to come across someone who will take a chance on committing a crime but won't take a chance on a lottery ticket. Interesting mindset, don't you think? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Indian police said they have detained a pigeon suspected of being a Pakistani spy after it was found to have a message stamped on its body. Punjab police said a 14-year-old boy in a village close to the Pakistani border brought the pigeon to a police station when he noticed it bore a stamped message on its wings, written in Urdu, which is the official language of Pakistan, and it also had a Pakistani phone number written on it. The pigeon's feathers also reportedly bore the seal of a Pakistani district in Pakistan's Punjab province. Officials at the Bamial police post dubbed the bird a suspected spy in a diary report. Police Superintendent Rakesh Kushal said police conducted an X-ray of the white pigeon. "Nothing adverse has been found, but we have kept the bird in our custody." Yeah. "This is a rare instance of a bird from Pakistan being spotted here. We have caught a few spies here. The area is sensitive given its proximity to Jammu, where infiltration is quite common." They've kept a bird because they think it's a spy. I wonder if they're torturing it to get it to talk. Yeah. Seriously, do you think if the bird were actually a spy that it would have so many seemingly official marks and stampings on it? I mean, talk about bird brain police work, huh? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Kevin Biggins is the co-executive producer of one of the most successful animated shows on TV. That's Family Guy. It first went on the air back in 1999, and it is still going strong. Kevin joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how you doing, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. As I said in the introduction, it is still going strong. But there was a period of time when it had a bit of a precarious situation. It was actually canceled by Fox. So having said that, though it is going strong, are you guys surprised considering the initial start?
No, because we think we're the funniest guys around. It's surprising that that Fox admitted they made a mistake. That's what we were most surprised at, and that they were able to bring it back. But that was back in the time when DVD sales mattered and people watched DVDs, if you remember those. They were small discs that you would put into a DVD player and watch on a TV, if you remember that.
Oh, I have the DVD. I have the DVD set of the shows, so I know exactly what you're talking about, and they're coveted. They're coveted in my collection.
Absolutely, I had them in college as well. So, we're very grateful that it is back and that it's continues to keep going. And, you know, we're just trying to ride it out and see, however long Seth wants to do it, I will work for him and do it. So, very happy to be a part of the show. It's a lot of fun, and there's a lot of very funny guys I get to work with every day. So,
well, one of the things you just alluded to. One of the things you just alluded to is the fact that the DVD sales were so popular, and that is because there was such great fan support. So clearly Family Guy has had a rabid fan support. You guys must be very appreciative of the people who have taken to the show so strongly.
Absolutely. I mean, it's great. You mentioned that you were at the Montreal Live show, and I got to, you know, I've been to a couple of those when they did them in LA, and one in Chicago, and that was really overwhelming to see the people come out, and just insane fans that are there early and stay late, and, you know, just want to get a glimpse of Seth and all the other people that do the voices and get stuff signed. And it's fun to see, you know, it's we're kind of in a little bubble out there in Los Angeles, and you know, you forget that there's all these people out there that really love it. So it makes you feel good.
Fox already had a long-running hit with The Simpsons when you guys finally came along. And like I said earlier, of course, initially you were canceled. So how do you separate yourself, or how much effort goes into separating yourself from what is already known as The Simpsons? I know that initially there was some competition between you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think we just try and tell more, toilet jokes, maybe? I think there was a little bit of competition. There doesn't really seem to be, I think there's a mutual respect. At this point, we just did a crossover episode last season that was a lot of fun. And, you know, I think most of the writers on the show grew up, you know, idolizing The Simpsons. And I know I did. And, you know, me and my friends in college, you know, would watch 3 or 4 episodes of Simpsons in a row and, you know, quote it. And we were big Simpsons dorks. And, you know, that's what kind of, you know, I always imagined wanting to write for Simpsons, or, you know, kind of just wondering what that life would be like. And it's kind of surreal to find myself in the, you know, in a writer's room where we're doing kind of an adult comedy. So it's really kind of a dream come true for me. And, you know, the thing that differentiates us a little bit is just, you know, our kind of cutaway style with flashbacks and different non sequiturs. And in that way, we can kind of just hit maybe a little bit more pop culture things that are going on. And I think we're probably a meaner show as well, but that's okay. But, you know, there's nothing but respect as far as Simpsons come. I don't know about South Park, but you'd have to talk to Seth about that.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned adults and surreal, and those are two things I wanted to touch on, and pop culture. The fact that you have a lot of jokes that I'm sure in some cases go over some of the audience's head because maybe they're not as in tune to pop culture. Is that some of the things you go for to hit an audience that gets it and appreciates it? Because it's sort of like a double thrill for the audience. It's like, I can't believe they just did that.
Right. With some of those, maybe the more surreal or obscure references, I've heard people call them like 10%ers, which are, you know, it's 10% of the country will get this reference. And sometimes it's kind of fun to put those in because you know that there's this small percentage of people that will really enjoy that. And I always enjoyed getting kind of the odd, you know, 80s references that we put on there. And, you know, of course we need to kind of update those a little bit because, our fan base is about, most of them were born, in the 90s now. So, But yeah, there's definitely things I think that that Seth and some of the older writers that have been there since the beginning will kind of push through, whether it's a reference from an older TV show, from the 60s, or just a little bit more of a obscure reference. They'll kind of push those through just as kind of, it's almost a guilty pleasure for them to get, some of their childhood memories and things that they're into on TV. And it's, it's just kind of about not really caring too much about the majority of people getting it, but just knowing that the people that do get it will really enjoy it. So, 10 percenters, they're called.
How is it dealing with the Fox censors? I assume there's, because sometimes, again, I watch the show and I say, wow, how did that get through? I mean, I laugh hysterically, but wow, how did that get through?
I'm surprised. We have the showrunners, Steve Callahan and Rich Appel, Rich used to be a Harvard lawyer. He went to Harvard Law School, and he was a district attorney in New York. So he takes care of a lot of that. I don't have to deal with that, thankfully, or a lot of the stuff would not get on because it's not my background. But they deal with a lot of that, and they do a great job. And they kind of, they're hard fought battles, and a lot of the time it's either proving parody or just basically bringing up other references from other shows, because a lot of the CBS shows get away with much cruder things than we're allowed to. And they're supposed to be like the family station, or, kind of the, more older, straightforward viewers. And it's just kind of bull because they get a lot of nasty stuff on TV. And, so it's like referencing that kind of stuff or things we've done in the past. And it's a lot of just kind of pulling from different examples and saying, hey, you let us do it before, why can't we do it now? But it's a constant battle. And believe me, there's a lot of stuff that gets left out. There's a lot of terrible things that get said in the writer's room that never make it to TV, thankfully.
I've had the opportunity to talk to several comedy writers over the years from various shows, and one of the things that seems to be in a common with them when dealing with standards and practices is they sometimes put in red herrings, putting in a joke that they know won't get through so they can save one that will. Do you guys do that?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never heard of that, but that's a clever idea. We should do that.
I reference The Simpsons, which is celebrating a milestone in itself in the amount of years it's been on television. Do you foresee your guys, now that you've been on for so many years, it seems like there's no end to this. Do you feel that way, that you can go on forever?
I'm trying to buy a house, so yeah, I really, I hope that's the case, but no, I don't think, it's pretty much up to Seth, whatever he wants to do and whatever he's feeling. And he's obviously a busy guy, and he's getting into making huge blockbuster movies. Ted 2 is coming out. I'll plug that. Everyone go see that. Or don't. I don't know if it's better, if that does well or not for Family Guy. I think it's Prime. I think it's better. So, but no, I think it's, as long as he doesn't feel too overwhelmed with the workload and, the rest of the people kind of pick up the slack and make him feel that it's running smoothly, I think it can go hopefully for at least 5 more years, and I'd be happy with 10. So I'm happy with 1. I'm happy to be working, but it's I think so. And I think we're still doing, I think, quality comedy and getting there's big laughs, I think, every episode on Sunday nights. And if you're laughing out loud 3 or 4 times at a show, at a sitcom, I think that's probably above average for what's out there right now. So we're just we'll keep producing the jokes as long as it's on. And I think we're right up there with the better comedies on TV right now. So
I hate to keep bringing up that other show as a reference point, but well, it's there, so I'm going to ask this last question, and that is, The Simpsons had a movie. How about Family Guy's theatrical release?
Oh yeah, that's that's been bounced around for a while, and supposedly there was one being written. I think it'll happen. Maybe as kind of a last thing, or when Seth gets a break from doing live action movies, maybe if he has some time to, sit down and decide the story. And I think that'll be the biggest thing is what'll make an exciting story for a movie, and will it kind of be the finale? Will there be characters that die, or so I think that'll be the hardest thing, is to do something that's so much different from the show that airs on TV that it'll be worth having on the big screen. So I would love to see it. I think it would be a nice thing for the fans, and I could definitely see that happening in the future.
Well, we hope that none of the characters die and the show goes on forever. I thank you very much, Kevin, for being a guest on the program. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it. And keep watching TV, folks.
Kevin Biggins, co-executive producer of Family Guy on Fox, and also here in Canada on Global. Check your local listings to find it. And of course, there are those aforementioned DVDs that are all out there. They're classics.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about wedding proposals. Plus, Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter. And, of course, there is an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on. Plus, much more Stuff File news right here, right now on a program also heard, wait for it, on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, this next story here, I toss this one in here just for Mike. Thank you very much, Mike, again. For doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program. A garbage truck operator in Gainesville, Florida, was unloading trash from dumpsters at an apartment complex when he was confronted by a man with a knife who demanded he get out of his truck. Naturally, the driver refused and moved on. But the man caught up with him again, this time armed with a can of pepper spray, which he emptied into the truck's air intake. The driver called for help. The man told sheriff's deputies he was trying to rescue his girlfriend from the truck. His imaginary girlfriend. 75-year-old Walter Welch was arrested and charged with aggravated assault, property damage, and, yep, cocaine possession. no girlfriends were found, which has likely been the case for him for a long, long time. Well, a New York City man whose first name is God has settled a lawsuit with a credit reporting agency that had refused to recognize his name as legitimate. Under the agreement reached in Brooklyn federal court, Equifax will enter God Gazaroff's name into its database. The terms of the settlement were not disclosed. Gazaroff now has a robust 820 credit score. He says he was shocked by Equifax's refusal to acknowledge his moniker. The Russian native is a Brooklyn jewelry store owner who is named after his grandfather. He says it's a relatively common name in his native country. He told the New York Post he's relieved that the matter has been settled and plans to buy a new BMW. Lawyers for Equifax declined to comment. Gee, you know, you'd think Equifax would be smart and use this in their advertising copy. I can just see the tagline now. Do you think you have a credit rating better than God? Call us and find out. Yes. Anyway, 81-year-old George Flint is the oldest lobbyist in the state of Nevada. He planned to keep it that way, but a heart attack prompted him to retire. In response, state legislators declared George Flint Day to recognize his outstanding and valuable contributions as Nevada's longest-standing senior lobbyist. Flint, most lawmakers like to call him Georgie, also has a day job. He's an ordained Pentecostal minister who runs a wedding chapel in Reno. Isn't that lovely? That's just lovely. Yeah. He started lobbying on behalf of wedding chapels 52 years ago, but spent the last 30 years lobbying on behalf of a different industry, Nevada's legal brothels. One goal he didn't accomplish, even after all that time, getting prostitution legalized statewide. It's not legal in four of the state's 16 counties, including Sin City itself, which is Las Vegas's Clark County, which brings an undesirable crime culture to the city all of its own, Flint says. Now, one goal he did accomplish early on, visiting the brothel as a client. I've never hidden the fact I've tasted that merchandise, he said. He says that one of Jesus' most loyal followers, Mary Magdalene, was a hooker. And if a prostitute was good enough for Christ, they're good enough for anyone. An argument that may work for Jesus, but probably won't work for George's wife. I'm just saying. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a fight over a self-serve waffle maker got heated at a West Michigan hotel over Memorial Day weekend. Mason County, Michigan Sheriff Kim Cole said 30 people were forced to leave the America's Best Value Inn in Pere Marquette Township following the scuffle. Apparently, there was a line at the waffle maker, and a couple of people felt an individual had cut in line, and that sparked a verbal argument, Cole said. One lady walked up to another lady and asked if she was in line for the waffle maker thing, and the lady never answered her, Cole said. So that first lady went and made a waffle, and when she went to go and take it, this other gal tried to take it from her, and that started the fight over the waffle. Cole said prejudices related to the ethnicity of one of the women in the argument may have played a role in the fight. The second lady was of Middle Eastern descent, and some comments were made about her not understanding English, Cole said. The argument escalated from there, eventually including more than two dozen people. In the end, there were no arrests, but deputies stood by as all the guests involved were kicked off the property. No one was injured, but the incident did put a strain on local police resources. We had two-thirds of our road patrol tied up with this fiasco, Cole said. You know, they must make some pretty damn good waffles if it can start a fight involving 30 people. That's all I gotta say. There's an advertising ploy that America's Best Value Inn might try to consider in this case. I'm just saying. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? June may be known as the unofficial wedding month, but it's also the month that many couples become engaged. For some, it's the next life move after graduation, while others get caught up in the romance that comes with wedding season. But there are good ways and bad ways to pop the question. On the line with us right now is Dr. Leslie Beth Wish. She is a licensed clinical psychotherapist and the author of Smart Relationships. She joins us on the line right now from Florida. Hi, Dr. Leslie Beth.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So clearly, I mean, we see this all the time, especially on YouTube and on television newscasts, kicker stories, somebody who decides to pop the question in a romantic or amusing way, and it either goes really, really well and tears start to well up in the viewer's eyes, or it goes horribly wrong. Both extremes we see all the time. So obviously there is a good way and a right way to pop the question, isn't there?
Well, those Jumbotron things and your picture and they rent off, you know, a surprise party for you. I mean, my gosh, that's really a big risk, isn't it? And what pressure. And there are movies that show those kinds of scenes. So I like to think in terms of the Goldilocks story, you know, in the Three Bears, where there's just right and too big and too small. So let's talk about what you're just talking about, the too big over-the-top proposal. So, you know when the proposal's written in the sky or it's, you know, done at the, you know, some stadium that's rented or some, you know, mountaintop or whatever, and it's very easy to get swept away. But keep in mind that proposals that suffer from too muchness can often be tells, and they might be telling you that these are men who need to be in charge, respected, and revered, and number one, two, and three in a relationship.
But people always assume, because the guy is the one that proposes, correct, in most cases.
In most cases.
But when you're part of a couple, when you're in a relationship, the number one thing is communication, correct?
You got it.
So if the number one thing is communication, if your wedding proposal is over the top, if someone perceives your wedding proposal to be over the top, isn't it really a situation where you know your spouse to be and she would prefer something over the top?
Now, if that's true, that is great. And that was exactly what I was going to say, that the most important things to consider when proposing is, are you sure this is the direction that your relationship is in? I mean, it shouldn't be a total surprise. You know, you should already have talked about kids and religion and values and working and all the important things. I mean, it shouldn't come out of the sky, right? And secondly, if you know that your partner likes big things or would like it or has always had this fantasy, these are things that, yes, then an over-the-top proposal is a good match. So there's no way to miss, at least not a very big, you know, big percentage of chance to miss, if you know your partner.
And speaking of getting to know your partner, I would assume in a lot of cases that if you're about to pop the question to someone, you've been in a relationship for a decent period of time, and you've probably discussed not necessarily your own relationship, although that's something you should do, but you've also discussed other people's relationships. And by that I mean you can gauge what your wife-to-be would like by seeing her reaction to somebody else's proposal.
Sometimes, and you can also see their reaction to when they're with another couple. And, you know, when you are with your partner in private and you say, my gosh, she treats him badly, or, oh my God, I can't believe that he, you know, chewed her out in public like that. And those are tells. And so a happy couple has done their homework. The proposal, yes, it should be very special. This is a ritual. This is one of those things that is a keepsake in your heart between you and your partner. It's a bonding experience. So when things go badly and you have rough times, you go back to those times when you fell in love, when your first anniversary was, when you proposed, how it happened. It's very important to do these things. But again, your point is so strong. If you know your partner and what they like, you'll know whether to, you know, rent out the mountaintop or the other side of the coin is, using the Goldilocks metaphor, too little of a proposal. When someone, I've had, you know, my client say to me, I can't believe my guy told everyone in the office that he was going to propose to me. And I walked into the lunchroom and he was down on one knee. She said to me, a proposal in the lunchroom? This is where it's going to be? She says, I didn't want that.
Well, how many proposals do you think, just generally speaking, regardless of how big or how small it is, How many proposals do you think are a complete surprise on a percentage-wise?
Pretty small, actually. Couples today are pretty smart about that. And, you know, don't forget that things are different now. You know, a long time ago, you know, when our parents were getting married, you know, there was a sense of surprise and specialness. Those kinds of pop proposals were, they were more, you know, accepted. It, particularly if there was pressure from the outside. For example, your partner's going off to war, okay? A lot of proposals happen at juncture points. When that's why they happen at graduation of college or, you know, master's degree or end of, you know, some assignment. So sometimes you kind of know that those proposals are going to happen, but they may not have been really talked about.
Generally speaking, do you like the idea of any kind of proposal in public, or should that be a private situation?
I think it should be. My preference would be more private, and my clients have said more private, but that goes back to what you said before. Know your partner. Know what each person wants. I've got one client who told her partner, I have a fantasy of being proposed to on a ski lift. I just would love that, some beautiful, you know, mountain winter view. And so he remembered that, and that's what he did. So ask your partner, listen to their reactions, just like you said, what they say about other couples. But be careful of, you know, making a decision about your marriage based on whether the proposal was exactly what you wanted. I don't want to give the impression that, you know, proposals that aren't just right are going to lead to a bad marriage. But these are things to think about.
Isn't it also in some cases putting the horse before the cart, as the old saying goes? Because in one's life, the biggest day of their life should be their wedding, should it not? Or the birth of their children. But in that order, usually, if you have this humongous proposal, how do you top that for the wedding?
And, you know, it's so hard because you're in that la-la land. Your brain is in la-la land. It's got so much oxytocin and other attachment hormones, vasopressin, all that going on. And that, you know, that glue, you can ride on that for, you know, 18 months, even 2 years. And so sometimes it kind of clouds your thinking. And you're right. Hopefully your whole life will be more exciting. Weddings tend to be pretty stressful. Sometimes they're not your best memories. But think about what you would like to communicate. I'd like your listeners to think about what they would like to communicate to their partner when they get to that point that they think this is really a go, about what kind of proposal they would like.
Good tips indeed. And I guess that's the kind of thing that you talk about in your book, Smart Relationships. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, I tend to write about things that bother me, and I have been bothered for so long about why so many of today's women who work are smart about work but not love. And even though I've been a therapist for decades, I didn't want to base my conclusions or observations just on those people, because the truth is, not that many people seek therapy as the TV shows and movies, you know, portray. So I did 5 years of research. I did surveys and workshops and followed a whole cadre of women for 5 years to find out what the mistakes are that they make.
And what was the most common mistake?
Well, the top ones are, after their heart has been broken, they say to themselves, I'm done with love, I'm done with men. That's it. And that's a very bad thing to do, because it shuts the window on your self-knowledge, and it doesn't put you back in the practice ring, because you learn about yourself by being with other people, and you get rusty at reading people, you know, their behavior. So don't do that. That was the number one mistake. The number two mistake was that, and this applied to men too, let's say that you got into a relationship where you ended up being in charge, whether you're the male or female, and it didn't work out. You took too much control, you made too many decisions, and what happened was, when the time came that the going got rough, you felt as though you could not rely on your partner. They were afraid to make decisions. They were 100% followers. And you need really a wingman or a wingwoman to be your partner. And so what these men and women did was they overcorrected the mistake. And they chose someone who they thought would be a decisive person, but they overcorrected and chose someone who wanted to run the show.
Again, good advice indeed. And people can find out more information about you and your book by going to your website, lovevictory.com. Leslie Beth, thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you. I love this topic, and I am so glad you called me to talk about it. So the last word of advice, tell your partner what kind of proposal you'd like, what your fantasy is, what kinds of values you have, what you're thinking about, where you'd like to live, near the family, far away from the family, children, your religion. Settle all those things first.
Excellent. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Leslie Beth Wish, author of Smart Relationships. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0302, and you'll find links to Leslie Beth's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. If you've ever used a laptop computer, you may have noticed that the power adapter can become very hot when the computer's charging. In fact, a hot adapter that's in contact with skin for too long can even cause burns. So it's not surprising to hear that a California woman who recently fell asleep with her arm resting on a power adapter woke up with a 1-inch boil on her arm. The boil has healed, but now she's suing the company in federal court. The operator's manual for the computer clearly warned against allowing the adapter to have prolonged contact with skin, but her lawyer argues there should have been even more warnings. Let's be fair, when companies make defective products, they should be held liable when someone is injured. But in this case, the power adapter complied with international standards for acceptable temperature limits. Because of lawsuits like this, most products today are plastered with warnings, so many that experts believe we often ignore them. In other words, having too many warning labels can actually make us less safe. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, here he is, direct from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, President Stuart Nauman.
Thank you, Peter. What would you expect? Chuck Todd or Bob Schieffer, maybe?
I've got to rescind that because you're Canadian. You can't be President of the United States, despite what one current Republican name in the race is saying. But anyway.
Yeah, that's right. I would violate the Constitution.
Exactly. And you wouldn't want to violate that, would you?
No, I think it'd be better if I worked for the White House, not as its main resident. Now, speaking of the White House, on this edition of Book Banter, yes, we are going to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, you know, because the public has always had a fascination with the most famous address in North America. You know, the White House, where the President of the United States, or POTUS, and the first family make their home for a maximum stay of 8 years since John Adams first settled there in 1800. And that fascination extends to the goings-on within the Oval Office, the meetings and state dinners at many conference and ballrooms, and the hectic pace that goes on amongst the ambitious, adrenaline-pumped staffers within the West Wing. However, the greatest fascination within the corridors of the White House deals with how the first family conducts their daily lives within the residence part of the place, a place that the average person rarely gets to discover, but are witnessed by the butlers, ushers, cooks, chefs, maids, and maintenance people who make up the White House staff. Now, usually the people who are tasked with the daily upkeep of the White House for the benefit and comfort of the first family usually keep the details of this inner life at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to themselves. sometimes from former staffers take that rare opportunity to share their stories of their life as a White House employee. Most recently, you could cite Lee Daniels, the butler, for that matter. Now the behind-the-scenes look at this private life at the White House, as seen by its many staffers, takes a new approach in Kate Anderson Brower's fascinating book called The Residence. Now, Brower is a veteran White House correspondent. She's interviewed a number of retired White House staffers and got them to break their silence about what it was like to work there and keep the executive mansion fully operational 24/7. The impression you get is that although they dedicated many exhausting hours and sacrificed their own private lives, families, and even their own health, their devotion to each first family that resided there was beyond question, and they would go to any length to make sure that their time in the White House was a comfortable home away from home experience, which I find pretty interesting. Now, a lot of the information that they indulge for the book gives a view of the president and the first family that even the most informed Washington insider or veteran political pundit never get their hands on. For example, White House engineers had to deal with Lyndon Johnson's constant quirky insistence of having the right type of plumbing and water pressure for his shower, which was a quest that lasted throughout the Johnson administration. Or the time they saw President Clinton emerge from his bedroom with a bloody cut on his face, which was as a result of being hit by a heavy book that was thrown at him by Hillary Clinton when she found out about his affair with Monica Lewinsky.
Do we know what the book was, by the way?
Well, I don't. Maybe it was Nixon's memoirs. I don't know. That was a big book.
Yeah.
Well, it couldn't have been War and Peace.
No, okay.
I doubt it. But the Residence is almost like a Washington version of Catherine Stockett's novel, The Help. But in this case, it shows how a dedicated core group of White House employees who have no power or influence with a government agenda or public opinion showed their dedication to the most powerful person in the free world and their families. And how, for most part, these first families gave back with their gestures or expressions of gratitude and appreciation. It basically gives a much more human, imperfect side to the institution that is the President of the United States, and makes us understand and appreciate how these hardworking staffers are able to bring out this human side to the ultimate face of political power.
Any of the living presidents sign off on this, or is this basically unauthorized?
And it's basically unauthorized, actually, but it's I don't think it's anything controversial, because a lot of these first families, I mean, look, Nancy Reagan didn't sign off on it, but again, Nancy Reagan's of an advanced age, maybe she wouldn't know about this right now, but the Bushes, both George H.W. and George W., were very kind to the staffers, and then vice versa, and they had a very, warm feeling about both Bush presidencies, because, you know, they were just very – in fact, you know what? George H.W. liked to play horseshoes with a lot of the ushers and the butlers on the lawn of the White House. He thought he was a very great person to work with and a very down-to-earth kind of human being.
Does it talk about Nancy Reagan's China policy?
Yes, it does talk about the China policy. In fact, about how her quest for perfection actually drove longtime resident staffer to resign, actually, and then after Reagan left, rejoined the White House staff.
Hmm. So the book is called?
It's called The Residence, and it's by Kay Anderson Brower, published by Harper, and it's $34.99.
And is there anything of a similar vein out there that you recommend, sir?
Yes, there's two books that come to mind, which are not in print, but you can always get a secondhand bookstore. That's what I love about secondhand bookstores. They're great, great jewels. One is by Lillian Rogers Parks. She was a maid at the White House. She wrote a book in 1961 called My 30 Years Backstairs at the White House, which became a miniseries in 1979 with Olivia Cole and Leslie Uggams. And J.B. West, who was the chief usher at the White House, he had a bestseller in 1973 called Upstairs at the White House. This basically focuses on how he worked closely with many of the first ladies from maybe Eisenhower up until Pat Nixon.
Interesting. Interesting. And this book again is called?
The Residence, Inside the Private World of the White House, and it's authored by Kate Anderson Brower. Publisher is Harper, and it's $34.99, and it's a New York Times bestseller.
Excellent. And how do people find you? Are you upstairs or downstairs in the White House?
Probably midway, actually.
Okay.
Probably in the mezzanine.
In the dumbwaiter.
Yeah, I could probably fit in a dumbwaiter. Yeah. Well, if you can find me within the corridors of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, you could see me every week in the Montreal Times in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca. Hail to the chief.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nallman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about in the home stretch for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way, but I got a couple more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now. Police say a Long Island man set his rental car ablaze while trying to kill bedbugs inside the vehicle. Scott Kemmery suffered first and second degree burns in the incident outside an Eastport supermarket. Police say the Bridgehampton man poured alcohol over the insects, then sat in the car and lit a cigarette, setting off the blaze. He fled the vehicle on his own. Detective Sergeant Edward Fitzgerald said that someone told Kemmery that if he saturated the bedbugs with alcohol, it would kill them. Police say two other cars were heavily damaged from the intense heat of the fire. Night, night. Don't let the bedbugs bite. Actually, we're not quite sure if the alcohol trick works. There's no word on whether the bedbugs survived or not. But anyway, moving right along. University of Wisconsin-Madison students completed a Rice Krispies cereal treat weighing more than 5.5 tons that they hope will be entered into the Guinness World Book of Records. The treat, born out of a dorm room dare of sorts, measured 10 feet by 10 feet by 6.5 feet tall, with a preliminary weight of 11,327 pounds, according to Cream City Scale of Madison, which was on hand to weigh the dessert. The colossus, made by combining Rice Krispies cereal, marshmallows, and butter, was more than 1,000 pounds heavier than the 10,314-pound Rice Krispies treat made in California in 2010, and that one is recognized by Guinness World Records. The students had been aiming for a 15,000-pound dessert, and manufacturers had donated 9,000 pounds of marshmallows, 5,500 pounds of Rice Krispies, and 900 pounds of butter for the effort. Danny Lerner, one of the organizers, said he was pleased with the results after challenges posed by raw weather and warping of the wooden mold used to make the treat. The dessert was up to raise money for Wisconsin charities. "We had an ambitious goal and we succeeded," Lerner said, adding that extra cereal will be donated to food pantries and other organizations that will accept them. You know, I'm assuming they're going to have to chop that thing up with a chainsaw. Full disclosure, I'm not a big fan of Rice Krispie treats when they're regular sized. At almost 12,000 pounds, that's just nasty. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, we have reached that auspicious moment of the program. You know what it is, boys and girls. Yes, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
An employee of a bowling alley in Decatur, Illinois, said she had been robbed. Police responded in force with 8 officers, but the robber had left before their arrival, she said. 30-year-old Jamie L. Gordon said she had been struck in the head with a bowling ball, and all the money, $2,100, had been stolen out of the safe. She was knocked unconscious and therefore couldn't describe the robbers. Officers quickly noticed a security camera covering the safe and asked the manager to pull up the recording. After watching it, the lead investigator says he told Gordon that he had just watched her strike herself in the head with a bowling ball twice on video and asked her where the stolen money was. Jamie sighed and stated, "Some of it is in my car." He led her out to the parking lot where she retrieved a Hello Kitty brand bag full of money and handed it over. But it was only $439. The rest, plus her paycheck and more, was lost in the establishment's slot machines, she said. Jamie admitted to striking herself in the head with a bowling ball in an attempt to make it look like she had been robbed. She, of course, was arrested. Well, talk about Hello Kitty. I think in this case we're talking Goodbye Kitty. But seriously, why does somebody who works at a bowling alley not take into consideration the fact that the place has video cameras when they're beating themselves about the head with a bowling ball? Well, one reason, and one reason only. They're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0302. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0302. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.